I'm Ed Levine. This episode of Special Sauce is being brought to you by W.W. Norton & Company, publisher of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, written by Stella Parks, Serious Eats' very own pastry wizard. In Brave Tart, Stella shares foolproof recipes for classic American desserts. Think sugar cookies, animal crackers, candy bars, and frosted yellow cake. With a historian's rigor and a scientist's curiosity, Stella documents the intriguing stories of how our favorite sweets came to be, and this is key, and the best methods for recreating these classics at home. As someone who has had the not-so-difficult task of tasting many of the treats Stella was developing for her book, I can personally attest to their serious deliciousness. So, if you want to delight your family and friends with homemade versions of the sweets we all grew up with, pick up a copy of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, wherever books are sold. Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture. Food folks and non-food folks alike. What's the one thing you learned there you've carried with you from the Georges Blanc restaurant?
Despite chasing the waitress.
We understand that you were chasing waitresses, but besides that, joining me today in the studio is chef restaurateur Daniel Boulou, a man I've known for, 20 years? Starting when my friend and squash partner Alex Lee introduced me to Daniel. When they were opening Restaurant Daniel together.
25 years ago.
Yeah, that's
Hello,
insane.
Ed.
Oh, my God.
So good to see you.
Simply put, Daniel Boulou is one of the greatest, most influential chefs in the world. He has many restaurants all over the globe, from New York City to Singapore to London. He's won so many James Beard Awards. I just asked him, and even he doesn't have a final number, but it's somewhere between 10 and 20 between him and everyone who's worked with him and for him, that he has no place to hang all the medals. Here to talk about the food culture and everything surrounding it, the great Daniel Boulou. Welcome to Special Sauce, my friend.
Thank you, Ed. I'm very proud to be in your program, and it's always so much in depth and so personal, and it makes me feel very privileged to be here.
Oh, well, it's a privilege for us to have you here. So this question is our standard opening question, but in your case, it's particularly resonant. Let's talk about life at the Boulou family table when you were growing up.
Oh, la la. So I choose to be a cook because I love food. And I think the memory I have of home was always food, 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 food.
You grew up in a tiny town outside Lyon?
Outside Lyon. And my parents were what we call cultivateurs in French, which is really farmers, but you basically raise everything, you grow everything, you make everything.
So they didn't specialize in dairy or
grain or produce. They did everything. We were also doing the farmers market once a week in Lyon. And I was helping, of course, my family at the farm. And I was helping my grandmother in the kitchen a lot because she was cooking for a dozen of people, breakfast, lunch, dinner.
Wow.
Between the help at the farm and my parents and my brother and sisters and uncle. And food was always the most important topic and the most important moment. And there was no one who will break the tradition of sitting down together and sharing that hour and a half of lunch or dinner around the table. No one could afford to be late. No one could afford not to show up.
That's fantastic.
And there was no phone, there was nothing, there was no TV, no phone, and the table was so animated, and the food, everything came from the farm. And it was a dream as a kid to be able to really enjoy the arrival of something, the strawberry, the green beans, the zucchini, the tomatoes, and all year long there were always the arrival of something.
And it's so interesting because when I listen to you describe it, it's clear that your family was way ahead of their time.
No, and my biggest regret is that I didn't get a chance to reproduce what I grew up with here. Because I had to choose, do I want to be a chef here or do I want to be a farmer? But difficult to do both, unless you are Dan Barber.
Right. Who's been on Special Sauce and talking about that very subject.
Yeah.
But what's amazing is that you've kept what's special about what you just described and incorporated it into your everyday life.
Very much. And that's why I think the seasonality ingredient, the passion for ingredient, the passion for tradition and for
grandmother food.
Grandmother's cooking. I think I always kept that a bit in me. Of course, as I became a young cook, I started cooking at 14. And I left home. And when I was 16...
Wait. We got to go back. We can't let that go. You started working in restaurants at 14?
Yeah.
And if you were Jewish, you would have just been bar mitzvahed.
Yeah, absolutely. It was going to still hurt, I'm sure.
And so you went to work...
Oh, no, I'm confusing bar mitzvah and circumcised. Yeah, no, you don't get circumcised when you do your bar mitzvah.
Exactly.
That's before.
You must be French. At 14, you went to work at a restaurant in Lyon.
Mm-hmm.
So
a two-star restaurant and one of the best traditional restaurants where the all the politicians, all the businessmen, all the Lyonnais, the society of Lyon were eating there every day. And so it was and the restaurant was next to Les Halles, the big market, the central market of Lyon. And after that, they moved the central market and they call it the Paul Bocuse market, Les Halles Paul Bocuse.
Named after the legendary chef.
But at the time, it was in that square just next door to the restaurant. So every morning I will go to that Les Halles, the market, the covered market, and I will go and pick up all the orders the chef I work for was giving to the suppliers to prepare for him. And of course... Paul Bocuse was there and all the great chefs of Lyon. And
right.
He was always leading the pack. And they, you know, he will kick your butt. He will tap your shoulder. He will say, hey, kid, how are you? And all that. And I grew up.
Amazing experience for
absolutely.
You.
And I grew up my entire youth as an apprentice surrounded by the greatest chef of France. I mean, because Lyon was the mecca.
Right.
Of chef at the time.
Blanc.
Georges Blanc, Alain Chapelle, Paul Bocuse, De Trois Gros, Roucou. Even, there was the chef from Point, but there was Pig. They were all gathering in that central
amazing.
Lyon because Lyon was kind of the magnet for the market.
Sure.
And at least once or twice a week, they will go to breakfast all together and eat those very sort of Pantagruelic meal of like tête de veau and...
Right, and you were a fly on the wall,
Beaujolais.
And so mm-hmm. thrilled to be a fly on the wall.
Oh yeah, no, more than a fly. I was one of those, market rat where
right.
I could see everything.
You were a sponge. You were just taking it all
yeah.
in.
Mm-hmm.
And did you always know you wanted to be a chef? Did your parents encourage you, or is it? I should say that Daniel is. Always been someone I've admired for his focus. Your focus is legendary in the food world.
It gets distracted sometimes.
But you always had that focus, even when you were 14.
Yes, and I think that my parents worry about me and didn't know what to do with me. And
That's because they're parents.
I was very turbulent at school. I didn't want to go study anymore. I had fight with my teachers. I was not a bad boy. I wanted to be free.
Yeah. You just didn't want to be there.
Exactly. And so they tried to put me at a cooking school outside of Lyon. And it was the worst school I ever been. And the cooking was so bad. And after 2 weeks, I said, no, I don't want to go there. I'm not going to go to that school. So they were kind of desperate. And I had the chance to... I have a friend with a very wealthy lady who lived in my village, and she was my lifeline because she said to my parents, I'm going to help Daniel, and we're going to find him a very good job in New York, in Lyon, to be a cook.
Wow.
And so she went to all the 2-star and the 3-star in the town and asked them, would you take an apprentice in June, which is the following month or the following few months? And Nandron said, yes, I have an opening. I'll take him.
Wow.
And so that's how it all started.
And did they kick your butt?
Oh, yeah. That was my first, you know, I started in late August or early September. August. And so the month of August was fine. And then soon as early September came in, the business started to really rumble again. And then game season, the chef owner there was a big hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And twice a week, at least, he will go hunting in Alsace. He will go hunting in south of Paris. He will go hunting in Burgundy. And he will come back and open the trunk of his car.
And that was it.
And the trunk of the car was full of game from everything, from wild hare to pheasant to partridge to woodcocks. Everything was in the trunk. And I mean, he must have been smelling hell to drive back to the restaurant, Leo.
Awesome. But
all those game. And I had to go and pick it up in the trunk and go in the basement.
And break it down.
And plug them.
God.
And I would spend a week down the basement, maybe 14 hours that day, a day, 14,
just
15
plucking.
Hours, just plucking birds. And being very careful to not break the skin. And because, you know, those birds have been shot. So sometimes, you know, they're shot in the legs or something. You have to be very careful. And thanks God I was coming from a farm where I know how to pluck birds. So that was no problem for me to pluck pheasant. But because I had this almost like kitchen smart instinct as a kid, because I was coming from a farm and
sure.
We know how to do everything. And we, you know, we are witnessing everything. Like when you, I mean, 3 times a year, we'll have young calf and we will break them down to just make meat for ourselves. The pigs, the calf, the goats, the baby goats.
That's amazing.
So, you know, I knew how to do a lot of things. And so, you know, they felt like, well, Danielle will be good to pluck birds.
But you quickly move past it. As you just mentioned, you spent time in the kitchens of everyone from Roger Verger to Georges Blanc mm-hmm. to Michel Girard. And what were those experiences like? And what did you take from each of them?
I think it was a gradual experience. And my apprenticeship, which was from the age of 14 to 17, 3 years of working in every station for at least 6 to 8 months in the kitchen in order to learn everything. And so I was also going to school twice a week to learn the academic side of it, but the practice was at work. And I think that prepared me very well for the next step. My dream was to go and work in a 3-star restaurant. And at the time, the restaurant Nandron in Lyon, where I started, they were part of this wonderful sort of family of restaurateurs.
Association
was called Relais et Château.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tradition et Qualité. So they were part of both associations. One was strictly restaurateur of the highest rank, and the other one was hotel and restaurateur of the highest rank. And I always dreamed to go and pursue my journey learning cooking throughout this sort of guide, because that was sort of a guiding direction. And if I work for one of those other places, it'll be a good place. And of course, I knew that Georges Blanc at the time was very young, and his mother, La Mère Blanc, was the chef before, and he was taking over. And I felt, well, maybe I should go there because there is things really happening at La Mère Blanc. There is change happening. The young, he was 26 or 27 when he took over.
Wow.
And working for a young chef, I was only 17. That was kind of like, you know,
almost
the thing
for
me.
Almost a contemporary. Yeah.
Yeah. And it really happened. I mean, I had 2 incredible years there where I could witness evolution.
Mm-hmm.
I could witness change because the tradition was really embedded there. And yet the son was trying to make his mark.
What's the one thing you learned there that you can recall that you've carried with you from the Georges Blanc restaurant?
Despite chasing the waitress.
We understand that you were chasing waitresses, but besides that.
No, I think I learned the tradition and the tradition of Burgundy, but also what it means to really have respect for tradition. Because there were five dishes who were the hallmark of La Mer Blanc. And one of them was écrevisse à la nage. And it was all about the seasoning of the courbouillon. It was all about the technique of...
And what's that dish in English?
And the écrevisse à la nage is crayfish in a broth, in a vegetable broth. And so you had to prepare the nage, which was measured with white wine and water and salt and spice and vegetable. And then after you had to cook the crayfish very carefully so they really remain very plumpy and firm and yet tasty, because the courbouillon had almost to have a very spicy... It's just like when you cook crayfish here and you put some Old Bay to give it a kick. That was kind of the French way of giving a kick. And then after they'll be chilled in that broth and then they'll be served whole to the guest, and the guest will have to break them themselves. You know, in a three-star restaurant, that's pretty...
Right, that's groundbreaking. You expect to do that in southwestern Louisiana.
Exactly. But it was part of this sort of traditional sophistication of eating crayfish there. But then after, there was the frog legs with the parsley, the garlic, the butter, there were almonds in the butter, and everything was measured perfectly. Then the butter with the garlic and the herbs and all that was so delicious, consistent, green, rich.
And contemporary, lush, and yet traditional.
Exactly. And the technique of cooking the frog legs was very particular to, you know, making sure you have a black steel pan and you have just enough fat and it has to crisp on both sides but stay very moist, and then finish it quickly with a very foamy butter with all this wonderful flavor of garlic and parsley and almonds and herbs, and then serve, and people will again eat the whole legs with their fingers and pull on the bones. And
right.
So it was this... to me, it has always been a sophistication and sort of like...
And earthy at the same time.
Earthy at the same time and casual.
Which is kind of the hallmark of your cooking.
Very much. But then also, very much. And then there were variation with the frog legs. There was a crème à l'échalote. There were other, preparation. Yeah, or in a vol-au-vent with like the rooster's coxcomb, and because that was the heart. This was the heart of the poulet de Bresse, and
which
poulet
is the
de Bresse,
famous chicken in France.
Exactly, and the poulet de Bresse is that famous chicken who can only grow in one region and can only grow under a very strict rule and regulation of feed and breeds and all that. And that's why they get the label of poulet de Bresse, and it's extremely controlled. Each chicken has a tag. Each chicken has a ring with a number on it.
Wow.
So when they are born, they put them a ring and a number, and that number carry them until they are, to be sold and all that.
Wow.
And controlled. So the poulet de Bresse, every morning we had to cook the poulet à la crème, which was the tradition because of the proximity of ingredients, which was the poulet de Bresse, the crème fraîche, the eggs from the poulet de Bresse, and so this... chicken in cream sauce, which in crème fraîche. And the preparation was very simple. You take a whole chicken, you break it down in 8 pieces, you season it well, you put up a large pan with butter, and you start to roast the chicken. When it's nicely roast, you keep adding, you add some onion to it. Then you keep roasting, and add enough butter. Then after you add 2 tablespoons, when it's well roasted, you add two big tablespoons of flour, and you create the roux. And you stir that with the butter, and now the foamy butter with the flour take flavor. You get the roux to get flavor. And then you pour water just to the ladle, and now you braise the chicken gently into that roux.
Oh, man, I'm getting too hungry.
And then when it's time to serve, then you take 2 cups of crème fraîche mixed with a little bit of egg yolks, and you pour that in through the hot roux, and you stir that, and you let the cream to just like barely curdle and all that. Then you remove the piece of chicken, and you pour that. That you pass that cream to a chinois China cap, and you let that cream like sort of covered and sort of swim around the chicken, and it's so good, the smell, the taste, and for me, I made that dish 100 times, and I was every time very excited to make it.
Wow, that's great.
And then you have the old mère blanc, the real traditional, the woman who knew everything before anyone. She was always over your shoulder looking how good you were at making it.
And, wow.
And then amazing. They had the crêpe venassienne also. The crêpe venassienne was with the leftover mashed potatoes one day. They just add some eggs and milk and made some crêpe. And it became this traditional crêpe venassienne, which is a little crêpe, a spoonful of that mix into a pan. And it created this beautiful galette. Small potato crepe, which are very light, and that again was another magical tradition.
I love how you can recall these things as if you'd cooked them yesterday.
Oh, totally! And I can still smell and feel the dish the way it was yesterday.
So, after these apprenticeships, you ended up
In the south of France.
Right, in the south of France. And then Denmark was really the first place you were running your own kitchen.
Exactly. So I went to the south of France, and I, the first thing I learned as a young chef is then by choosing to be a chef, I could see the world. And I think we see that today with American chefs where, they want to travel, they want to discover other country, other cuisine. And for me, it was not about discovering other country, other cuisine. It was more about discovering France, other region, other cuisine.
Because every region in France has a very distinctive cuisine.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think what gave me this bug for traveling is when I was 15, after my second year in apprenticeship, the owner of the restaurant in Lyon closed the restaurant for 1 month, 1 month and a half in the summer. And he told me, he said, Daniel, you don't need vacation. I'm going to send you to the Pays Basque. Because of course at the Pays Basque, they were very busy with the seasonal summer season. It's like going to Cape Cod, you know what
right.
I mean? I'm going to send you to Cape Cod because I have my friend who has a nice place there and he needs cooks.
That's amazing.
So I went there and I spent 2.5 months, 3 months in the Pays Basque.
That's in the Basque region of France.
Totally in the corner of the southwest of France, just before Spain.
Spain, right.
And it was just so interesting. And it was the first time that I really left Lyon for a long journey like this. And discovering this region was, to me, it showed me how much I had to see and learn in this world of cooking. And the magical part of that restaurant there. Of course, I learned a lot of Basque sort of dishes, local dishes. But every morning, a farmer there was coming down from the mountain with a bucket full of trout, and right off the river up there, and that will be the trout we will prepare. We will wrap the trout in jambon de Bayonne.
In ham,
jambon de Bayonne, and then we'll braise that trout very quickly in heavy cream, and poach in heavy cream with the jambon de Bayonne.
You get me too
hungry.
It
was beautiful.
So, but then you ended up in Denmark.
Yes. So, from Georges Blanc, I went to the south of France to do my Tour de France.
Right.
And Roger Verger just had 3-star Michelin at the time at the Moulin Mougins in Cannes, north of Cannes. A little village, Mougins. And I wanted to go there, and I asked Georges Blanc to help me. No problem. He make a phone call. I have the job. So now I get to Cannes, and I spent 2 years learning la cuisine provençale, the cuisine of Provence, the Mediterranean, and really what Verger called the cuisine of the sun.
Right.
And I think that was, again, another revelation as a chef to be able to learn a repertoire that was so different than Lyon or Burgundy. And I did that for 2 years, and I wanted to go back home to Burgundy or to Trois Gros or Chapelle. They were great chefs at the time, and I wanted to continue to learn. And Roger Verger said, oh, well, Daniel, I have a better idea for you. I have a wonderful job for you in Denmark where you could be a sous chef. And so I was, what, 20 years old?
Wow.
21. And I was this
executive. And you could
executive.
Teach, yeah, you could teach the Danish chef.
Exactly. About the cuisine of Roger Verger. So I went there. And I worked a year and a half, and then I felt I was way too young. I needed to go back and work another 3-star. Because, you know, time goes quick, and if you don't sacrifice yourself young, it's difficult to go back. And so that's what I did, and I went to work for Michel Gérard. So Denmark was fabulous. Denmark was already in sort of, there was no evolution because, frankly, there were no chef. There were no really great chefs until
exploring
Nouvelle Cuisine brought up some.
Yeah,
exactly. And I think this was the beginning of great chef in Denmark and Danish chef coming to work in France and go back home and really starting to make a mark there and starting an entire generation. So this happened in the late 70s. And I think it was very interesting to see already the individual work of Danish chef trying to not be French and yet had no other sort of code to learn from than the French cuisine.
Sure.
So they were kind of...
They were trailblazing.
Exactly. They were leaning on what they knew, what they learned, and trying to create something different. And that was very interesting.
That's interesting. And so why did you end up wanting to come to the States? Like, how did that come about?
So after leaving Denmark, I go to Michel Gérard, the southwest of France. Now I am north of the Pays Basque in the southwest. And again, Michel Gérard just had 3-star. And that was the place I wanted to go because I loved the artistic side. And each chef I worked for always brought me something special.
Right.
Either one was a poet, the other one was a dreamer, the other one was an entrepreneur, the other one was a more traditionalist.
Sure.
And I think Michel Gérard was really, at the time, and still now, the most poetic chef of all and the most, he chose to go from Paris to the southwest of France, and also he was a pastry chef to start with, and he became a chef. And so his mind was always working a little differently, and I enjoy spending a year there and learning a lot of fantastic dishes who was certainly based on traditional technique, but very creative and personal. And then after I went back to Denmark after that to work for a very young restaurateur who was starting his own restaurant. And that was his first place. And we were a small brigade and we had so much fun. And he was very artistic. It was like opening a restaurant in Brooklyn, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And for those young chefs who are like, you know, 40 seat.
Right, and full of fire and passion.
Yeah, and 5 people in the kitchen. And and so it was fantastic, and I had this opportunity. And then after, a friend of mine who I work with at Verger called me and say, hey, Daniel, I have this offer to go to Washington, D.C. as a private chef, but I cannot go. I have children. I'm kind of stuck here with my job. But if you like, I'll put you in touch with them.
Wow.
And so in 1980, I got in touch with the ambassador who was moving to D.C. He was actually not an ambassador, but a head of delegation.
Right, sort of a trade delegation.
Yeah, trade delegation of the EU. That was really the beginning of the EU then.
Got it.
And so they had this representative here, and he was a French gentleman from Normandy, of a well-do family, and he wanted a good chef, a good young chef. And his wife also cared about having a good chef. She was from England. And so they brought me to D.C.
And
I arrived.
You were 23?
25. 25, 25. And I arrived, you know, I had a visa, I had a car, I had an apartment, I had a job, I had a lousy salary, but that was okay. And I didn't care. I came, and the first thing I did, I arrived in D.C., I dropped my suitcase, and I went straight to Jean-Louis Paladin's restaurant because I knew his restaurant from the Southwest when I worked at Michel Girard.
Jean-Louis Paladin is, of course, the seminal
French chef. Absolutely.
Who opened a restaurant in Washington, D.C.
At the Watergate.
At the Watergate, which was sort of ground zero for...
Ground zero for all those chefs who were doing this tasting menu kind of restaurant where, you know, it was... Jean-Louis was all about his cooking or nothing.
Right.
And he was, you know, he was writing the menu in the afternoon.
Yeah, he definitely pushed the pedal to the metal.
Oh, totally. And and also with his suppliers. He forced the suppliers to dive. He forced the suppliers to raise stuff for him, to dig grounds for him, and to really... He knew then they were such an incredible
bounty
of supply.
Sure.
Then he had to kind of restructure a little bit the supply chain, and especially for his restaurant. He was teaching a retired lawyer who became farmers to how to raise his squab, to what size, to what feed, to what how to kill them, or to and all that. So he was extremely passionate. And so for me to go to see Jean-Louis there, it was kind of my get-go. I mean, always and then the chef of the French embassy, Francis Lerle, who was there also from the Southwest, and there in Washington for already 10 years or 12 years.
Right.
So, I mean, I had already friends there.
So there was a community for there you to...
There was a community, and a community of very good cook, very good chef. I right away felt good there in D.C., but then, you know, private chef was not a reality for me. It was just a sabbatical. And so I did it for 2 years, and then I wanted to come to New York. I had the chance to... I was very good friend with a very good pastry chef New York had for a while, was Jean-Pierre Lemasson. And Jean-Pierre Lemasson was a pastry chef at La Côte Basque, pastry chef at Périgord Park in the late 70s and 80s. And then he became a teacher at the CIA and he passed away. But Jean-Pierre was a good friend from the time where we worked together at the Moulin de Mougins in Verger. And he was here in New York. And one day he said, do you want to come to La Côte Basque and maybe do a stage? And I spent 1 month in La Côte Basque. And because Jean-Jacques knew that I worked with Roger Verger, Jean-Jacques Rachoud, the owner of La Côte Basque here in New York, said, oh, Daniel, just come and make some terrine and pâté and terrine. So I was there for 1 month making all the different terrine and pâté of seafood, of fish, of meat, of vegetable. And this month in New York gave me such a boost because in the kitchen were there Charlie Palmer, the from Olive in Boston.
Todd English.
Todd English,
yeah.
And so many young chefs, Frank Crispo, and
full of energy and passion.
They were just coming out of school, working at La Côte Basque. They were working so hard, but with such an energy and a passion, that I felt, oh God, I got to come in New York and work with those kids because they are really amazing.
So you moved.
And I moved to New York and I started on Madison Avenue and 69th Street at the Westbury Hotel, at the Polo Lounge, which was just reopening. And then I opened the Plaza Athénée for the same group of hotel. And at the Polo Lounge, in the kitchen were Bill Yosses, who has been
the White House pastry
chef for many years now has his own business.
Yeah,
They were Alfred Portal in the kitchen.
From Gotham Bar and Grill.
They were Thomas Keller in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And there were many more, and including Ray Bradley, who goes to Brooklyn at the farmer's market still. And Ray now lives upstate, but he was a chef de partie. He was coming from Le Cirque. With David Chack also and many other chefs who they
and
were.
And so that's how you ended up at Le Cirque?
Well, indirectly, but already when I came to New York, I kind of attracted some great cooks from all over.
Got it.
La Côte Basque, Le Cirque, Le Cygne, and all that. And then little by little, made a name for myself. And then I went to Le Cirque, and Jeffrey Zakarian was there. Alain Sayac, of course, I replaced Alain Sayac, the great chef there. And Jeffrey was a sous chef of Alain. But then when Alain moved to, I don't remember if that was the 21 Club, I think, or the Plaza, then Jeffrey moved with him, you know, loyal to his chef.
Sure. And so you ended up, and that's where you first came to everyone's attention, right? Was it Le Cirque?
I mean, maybe before, but more to the foodies' attention a little bit.
Really,
but then
you had to be really an insider, until Le Cirque, and then
you
were front and center.
Front and center, because Sergio Macioni, the owner of Le Cirque, was certainly already front and center for quite a while with this business, and Le Cirque was the most magical place on earth, with an energy, real great professionals and great clientele. And I was there to just make sure that the food keep evolving and the cooking kept evolving. And I think it was an amazing school to young chef as well. It really, it was the school of the 80s, I will say. There were many schools in America for young chefs, such as Wolfgang Puck in LA at the time. And when I was at Le Cirque here, there was also Quilted Giraffe was another school who was fantastic.
Sure.
The Four Seasons restaurants and all those French restaurants like Caravelle, La Grenouille, Le Cygne. But I think Le Cirque was maybe, we were a little bit of cast above in a sense of trying to push harder and harder. I mean, at least I was pushing harder and harder in the kitchen.
You never fail to push harder and harder, even now. You know, I don't think you're capable pushing hard, which is great, which is one of the things that makes you great.
Yeah, so, but, you know, when, I don't know, I started with nothing, and I don't think I have accomplished too much, but I'm very proud of what I've done in the last 30 years, and especially with education and how many young chefs I've been able to help in their career.
For sure.
And today, with Thomas Keller and Jerome Bocuse and I don't know, 50 of the best chefs in America, we have created this foundation called Mentor. And Mentor BKB, anybody can go online and look at Mentor, M-E-N-T-O-R, BKB. And that's a foundation where we support young chefs.
Right, and you're paying it forward.
And we are giving them grants to be able to travel the world and discover other chefs while they are working for us or for anyone in America who can apply. And it's wonderful. And then we also support the Bocuse d'Or competition who, you know, In a world of a restaurant business, is it necessary to do competition? Maybe not, but in the world of challenging young chef with opportunity to do something very unique for their country, I think it's
an important
fantastic
step. Yeah. I know you have to go, but I want you to come back. Will you come back?
Oh, yeah. I'll be back.
All right. Thank you. That was awesome.
Superb. Bravo.
This episode of Special Sauce has been brought to you by W.W. Norton & Company, publisher of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, the first book by resident Serious Eats pastry wizard Stella Parks. The recipes in Brave Tart are awesome, original, and rigorously tested. That's why they really do work. Plus, Stella is so smart, so curious, and such a good writer, you can happily read Brave Tart from cover to cover. I have. Like it wasn't a cookbook. It's equal parts science, history, and sweets mythology explained and debunked. I know what you're thinking. As a Serious Eats overlord, I'm hopelessly biased when it comes to Stella. And I probably am. But you too will think she's swell when you get your own copy of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, wherever books are sold.